Welcome to Journeys of Discovery, a Changemakers collaboration with the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra. I'm Michael Heyman, and today we're at the Royal Albert Hall in London, where I'm joined by the journalist, broadcaster, and author, Cathy Newman. As a lead presenter on Channel 4 News, Cathy is known for holding power to account and getting to the heart of a story. But before journalism came music and a talent for the violin. And in this episode, Cathy reflects on her early ambitions, the moments that shaped her career, and the role of music along the way. Cathy, welcome to the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra. Welcome to Journeys. I feel like I'm going to be on my interviewing A game today.
This is the boots on the other foot.
Well, it is. I mean, and I was thinking about the headlines we might be going for. You know, Cathy Newman is on the fiddle was the first.
World's tiniest violin.
Let's get it. You are a violinist and a very accomplished one. I've been listening to you on Twitter. I mean,
I think was.
Was.
Accomplished, maybe. Amateur, enthusiastic, let's just say.
But part of a parliamentary string quartet, the statutory instruments.
Yeah, love that, yeah. So we have Fagham Debonair, who unfortunately lost her seat, but we're still going to call ourselves the statutory instruments. But she was Labour MP, she was going to be culture secretary.
Because she had a culture. Yeah.
So she's the cellist, she's professional standard cellist. We have Catherine Sheba on the viola, and she plays a lot of professional music now, so she is very definitely concert standard. And then Emily Benn on first violin, who's well known around Parliament, granddaughter of Tony Benn. But I feel like for all of them, they're professionally trained,
right.
And so I feel very much that I am the kind of poor relation. I'm just riding on their coattails.
You're riding on their coattails, but yeah. Well, let's go back. I suppose everybody's at different levels in music, but I mean, obviously that this was a passion. I mean, you talk about music, you work hard to provide opportunities for people to experience music. How was your journey into music? When did this passion, when did the lights go on?
Well, I think you have to go back to me having chicken pox as a child, and I'd sort of tried a bit on the piano and it hadn't really sort of worked for me. I must have been about 4 or 5, that kind of, so my parents had this piano and my mum had never really been given the chance to learn when she was a child. So she was very keen that we learnt. So the piano was there, but it didn't really sort of gel. I don't know, I couldn't coordinate the hands, I think. So then I had chicken pox. I was at home, and my dad, was a chemistry teacher, he came home from school with a violin that someone had just, he was just like, oh, they were...
This is a totally random incident.
Yeah, totally random. Yeah. And I just loved it. And, stuck at home playing chicken pox, I was sort of plucking away and, just getting to know what the instrument was like. And then I started learning with a teacher, nearby. I just had absolute passion for it.
Were your mum and dad musical?
Not really. I mean, like I say, they'd always wished they'd been given a chance to learn, and they hadn't really had that opportunity. So when they became parents, they were very keen that we had that chance, me and my sister. And I think my mum was, because she was a teacher as well, so they had this kind of like educational zeal, really. Mm-hmm. And my mum read this book called, I think it's called The Children Who Live on the Hill, and it was like a sort of progressive educational book about the way to parent was to see what your kids were interested in and then give them everything they needed to fuel that interest.
Right.
So my mum adopted this approach with music. She could see that we were both into music, and she kind of just threw everything at it.
Massive encouragement.
So, yeah, massive.
I mean, I'm just thinking, we're here at the Royal Albert Hall, we're just listening to all of tonight's preparations for Chopin. It will be amazing in terms of a live experience. Do you remember your first live experience?
Well, funnily enough, I'm pretty sure one of the very first was here with Alfred Brendel.
Right.
Playing, I think, Beethoven Emperor Concerto. And my memory, it's all very hazy because I know I definitely saw the Tchaikovsky Violin Concerto at some point here as well. But it's...
And what was this, a childhood experience?
My parents brought us up here. We lived in Surrey, so it was, a bit of a trek. But, my mum had a very formative experience going to the Edinburgh Festival. And so she, I think, must have been the proms.
Right.
I don't think we were promenading. I think we got a posh seat.
Yeah.
And it was a real sort of family treat. But,
Did it make an impression on
you? Yeah, I mean... I used to say that the Emperor Concerto slow movement was what I wanted played at my funeral, but then I sort of thought about it and thought, it's got to be violin, doesn't it?
Yeah,
so it's got to be slow movement at the Tchaikovsky Violin Concerto, right? It's one of my favourite pieces of piano repertoire.
I mean, it's going to be absolutely amazing.
I'm sure. I can't wait.
And but I also think there is just something about you come to sort of a concert and it has so many. You never kind of hear it the same way twice. Mm. I think. I mean, everything creates a kind of impression. It creates a kind of emotional reaction
and a memory.
And a memory exactly. I mean, so on that kind of emotional part of music is. It quite often brings out something different in people. Mm. What does it bring out in you?
I think music was absolutely the kind of soundtrack of my childhood. You know, it was something that, you know, we didn't have a telly, ironically, given what I went into. So I was slightly, my husband always thinks it's really funny that there's kind of huge pop cultural experiences that I just missed out on as a child because we didn't have a telly and I wasn't really into pop music. Mm-hmm. So I suppose the substitute for that is we used to compete in these little music festivals nearby. There's one called the Bramley Music Festival. And if you won a prize, you got a goblet. And I remember one prize I won was a record that dates it, doesn't it, of Heifetz playing the Tchaikovsky Violin Concerto. And so that, it's things like that. And, you know, coming to the proms here, you know, Edinburgh Music Festival, it's things like that that you just remember. And I knew every note of that concerto.
And that soundtrack of your life, because that's so interesting. I mean, I was reading something where it said that you'd be as happy playing the honky-tonk piano as you would be violin. And so it goes more than just strings and classical.
I'd love to be able to sit down and just play the piano, and I can't. Whereas I can, you know, I could just pick up the violin now, even though I haven't practiced for months, and love it and love playing.
I had an uncle that could play the honky-tonk piano.
Yeah, but respect.
He never read music, but he could play like an incredible level of detail. And it was one of those things you just think back to your childhood of actually that whole sound, everything's marvelous.
But there's something sort of in your DNA you go with certain instruments because I couldn't just sit down at the piano and play any old piece. I couldn't do that. I couldn't sight read it. Whereas the violin, it's sort of instinctive.
It's instinctive.
And singing as well.
Because we were just talking a moment ago, I love strings as well. I mean, it just does something to me in terms of the experience, the kind of the... I always go very weepy, very emotional, very quickly. It's sort of like, it's the instrument that gets me. I mean, is that...
Well, but also, it's so versatile, isn't it? You know, you kind of... I went to see the Red Priest at they played just Vivaldi. I might have got the name slightly wrong, but you know, there's that sort of energizing effect of hearing strings playing something fast and furious, you know. But then also, some of the most emotional moments of my life.
Yeah.
You know, I played Salut d'Amour at our wedding, for example. I actually played Massenet's Meditation.
We are creating the ultimate playlist for
this. I'm just giving you all the cues.
Yeah, we're going to have to actually put this together for you.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, my greatest hits. But yeah, you know, I played actually the Massenet at someone in our year took her own life in the first week of my time at university at Oxford. And it was just the most harrowing experience for everybody and for her family, clearly. And I played the Massenet at her memorial service there. And so, you know, things like that for many, many years afterwards, I couldn't actually hear that piece without feeling upset. And then I felt that I had to kind of reclaim it somehow.
Because
you've got to be able to divorce music. Because
you're also right. I mean, because I'm just thinking about particular types of music, but it is... I mean, I've seen violinists that are basically... So much energy is coming through the instrument. Mm. I mean, and actually the physicality of it, the way that, you know, sort of 300-400-year-old sort of pieces of kit are just thrown around.
Yeah.
And actually, I mean, it can be absolutely amazing. How far did you think you were going to get with it, Kathy? I mean, did you
say... Well, when I was growing up, I would say I wanted to be a violinist.
Right.
And I would dream of that. As you get sort of more realistic, the older you get, don't you? And there were these very... very influential two old teachers who were friends of my parents. They were two old spinsters. And I remember Frances, one of them, who was very sort of down to earth, she said to me, "Oh, you don't want to be a violin teacher. That's a dog's life." Because by that point, I think I'd realised I was never going to be good enough to be a performer on, you know, a soloist.
Yeah.
I wasn't interested in playing an orchestra, I'm afraid. Much respect to the RPO, but...
Was there a moment where you just thought, this is as far as I can?
Well, I think a bit of a crossroads was I auditioned for the Yehudi Menuhin in school.
Yeah.
And they... said I was quite young and I hadn't had very good teaching at that point. Later, I learned with Dona Lee Croft at the Royal College, and mm-hmm. she was amazing, this incredible, larger-than-life sort of redheaded Texan. And she was
I was reading about her.
Brilliant.
She sounded
amazing. I mean, she was... So I feel like if I'd auditioned when I was learning with her, I might have taken a different route. But anyway, I auditioned when I'd had quite a sort of amateur experience. And they said they could see something, and they said, come back next year. And it was at that point that it was a bit of a crossroads. I just thought, actually, I'm not good enough to be like a prodigy on stage, you know? So I suppose I sort of dialed back into my schoolwork. I still was very passionate about the violin, but I thought, oh, you know, I'll be in a quartet. And then again, you'd sort of progress. And then we got a telly when I was about 16.
And
I saw basically screwed it all up. But no, I saw KAD standing up being a war reporter. And I thought, okay, never mind the violin. This
Here's
old lady,
else.
Frances, says it's a dog's life being a violinist anyway. I'll go and be a journalist.
Well, look, let's go. strings to stings. Let's move on. So KAD, she was the sort of the inspiration in terms of being a breakthrough, strong female reporter on the front line. Pick up the story. What were you seeing?
I haven't actually got round to being a foreign, war reporter yet. So, I mean, that's still to come at the age of 50. So that was definitely inspiration because I think, you know, there weren't that many women on TV. Mm-hmm. So it was like, oh, a bit of a revelation. Oh, you can be a woman on TV and do something that isn't
incredible.
Just sitting behind a desk. So that sort of fueled me. I did lots of student journalism at Oxford.
Right.
Not loads.
Is there any musical link to this? I mean, is that stretching too far?
There is, because as a presenter now, I mean, I was a print journalist for quite some time, so that's a sort of different cup of tea. But as a presenter now, there is an element of performance about it. You know, I always think the best presenters are sort of who they are on screen, same as off screen. However, you do have to sort of slightly dial it up.
Is it rhythmical?
You've got to listen to the
timings. Sometimes the relationships and your forming can be quite...
Yeah, you've got to listen to who you're interviewing and you've got to know the right moment to jump in. And, you know, so there is a rhythm to it. And, I think there's also that obsessiveness that you need as a musician. You kind of... That's quite useful as a journalist, not letting go of a story. You know, just... determined.
And finding your voice, I guess.
Yeah.
Because today we know Cathy Newman as a fearless interviewer, somebody that's going to, if there's truth to find, you're going to find it.
That's a big pressure.
Well, I can imagine, right? But I mean, but that's what we want, right? That's what we tune in to watch, is because, you know, we want somebody that's going to hold people's feet to the fire. But I'm imagining that was a journey all of its own.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, when I started as a print journalist, it's quite funny actually, because I applied for a whole load of traineeships and didn't get them. Mm-hmm. And I always say this to young journalists and, you know, young people in schools. I do a lot of mentoring at schools and so on. And I always say to them, don't worry if you don't succeed at first, because I didn't get any of them, you know, any of the natural routes in. So I definitely lacked a bit of confidence.
How did you keep going? What was the...
I remember once one of the interviews, they said, oh, what's your absolute ambition? And I was like, oh, I'd like to be media editor of The Guardian. And they were kind of like, oh, is that it? You know, so it's that kind of thing, just sort of realising that you can have an amazing goal and go for it and having the confidence to do that. And, you know, I remember I looked really, really young. I know it's hard to imagine now, but I looked really young for my age. And so I remember once I went to interview a big European broadcaster for the FT because I was media correspondent. Yeah. Ironically, I'd sort of achieved a bit of my ambition at that point. And I went to interview him and he looked at me. I came into reception. He looked at me and said, oh, no, there's some mistake. I'm being interviewed by the FT.
Right.
And I said, well, I am the FT.
And so
I suppose you learn from things like that, you know, I was... able at that point not to go, oh my God, I must look so, you know, in my head I was thinking I must look so young and inexperienced, he's not expecting me, but it didn't sort of crush me.
Right, and being a woman in media, part of a generation that's breaking through, part of actually you've got to go out there and make your own luck, you've got tell us a little bit about that side.
Well, although it did sometimes have advantages in that, for example, when I was media correspondent, it was a big press conference with Rupert Murdoch, Sam Chisholm, the guy who was running Sky. You know, it was such a big event, those big sort of media baron press conferences. Mm. And I was probably one of the very few women in the room. So, of course, they picked me to ask a question. And, you know, Rupert Murdoch quite enjoyed that kind of little sparring. So, you know, it can have its advantages. But, you know, there's a lot of... I've talked in the past about, you know, the sexual harassment that goes on in Westminster, you know, that I experienced. And, well, it was an issue at school as well. But, you know, that was also a male-dominated environment, my sick form. But I think you sort of...
I'm sort of thinking, when you've experienced that, what's the kind of the leftovers in your mind about actually how you approach the world today, how you approach, you know, presumably...
Well, I think that's why I've ended up doing a lot of stories championing people whose voices don't get heard, so women abuse survivors, but also the church story that I've just... been doing, you know, the abuse survivors there, because I think there's an empathy there that you sort of, you know what it is to be a victim of sexual assault. I mean, very different circumstances for me, obviously, than for them, but you want to listen to people and hear their stories and help them tell their stories.
And does it give you a fire as well in terms of getting to the truth, finding things out?
And wanting to change the world and hopefully try and make the world a better place. I mean, it sounds cliched, it sounds a bit corny, but, you know, I do think journalism, particularly now when there are so many injustices around the world and there's so much wrongdoing that needs exposing, I think there's a huge responsibility there, but also a huge... you know, it's public service journalism, I think, has never been more important around the world.
Well, let's talk about that through the lens of Channel 4. So this, I suppose, where your public prominence really did go to the next level in terms of people being able to watch you every evening, follow your stories. In terms of actually moving from print journalism to broadcast, tell us a little bit about that.
That's
that transition.
Not
that's
as
a big
easy
one,
it
right?
seems. Yeah. Well, one of the things was because I'd been doing sort of punditry on TV when I was at the FT, and that's what gave me a little bit of a sort of idea. Well, this might be quite fun. Mm. But punditry is so different because when you're a newspaper journalist, you can basically say what you think.
Yeah.
Of course, when you get onto TV, as you know, well, I was political correspondent first. There's all these Ofcom rules that you've got to obey on impartiality. So at first...
Do you find it hard being impartial? I mean,
well, it is, because, you know, at first I arrived thinking, oh, I can just do what I did on newspapers. Well, you can't.
Yeah.
So you feel slightly restricted, and you have to be careful all the time. Am I being fair? Am I giving both sides equal representation? You know, am I making sure I've got a right reply in there? You can't just wing it. You've got to think very carefully. And so that was hard.
And I'm presuming it might even have an effect on your own performance in terms of actually how you actually handle an interview.
Well, I think initially I probably planned everything too much, and that, you know, that sort of hems you in a bit because I didn't want to go wrong and fall foul of all these rules I'd just learned applied. And you almost have to sort of shed some of that information and sort of focus on. So, you know, I used to write out every question in immense detail, and, you know, with 60 million follow-ups. It's more of a sort of bullet point situation.
Do you ever look back on your old interviews?
Oh, God, no. No, I can bear to do that. No, it'd be awful.
Because I always think, well, when you see things of yourself like 10 years ago, oh my God, I'm so embarrassed.
Funnily enough, with the church story, I did, because I was interviewed about that yesterday for several hours, and I did watch back some of my early coverage, which was 8 years ago, and I was amazed at how sort of, I don't know, well, how much younger I looked, obviously, but also just how sort of buttoned up I was.
Yeah.
And that made me think, oh, maybe I've chilled out a bit. My old age.
I was just while you were speaking, I was thinking there's a great Iris Murdoch line which said, jump and a net will appear. And I sort of think that thing about just revealing who you are, revealing your inner self, where in an interview situation, of course, which is the most unnatural thing in a way, the best interviews I often think are the most natural, where there is a clear rapport, you're able to bring things up. But
TV mitigates against that because you've got kind of potentially 4 minutes with, you know, a politician that you want to know all sorts of things about, and you just, the timing is the enemy of being relaxed.
How do you feel about the political interview? I mean, is that something you enjoy, or is...
I mean, I love interviewing politics. Interviewing politicians because I love politics,
right.
And I'm, you know, that was where I kind of cut my teeth
as a
TV journalist. Yeah, you know what? They're characters. Right. And that's the worst thing about doing an interview is if you interview someone boring. Mm-hmm. You know, and that obviously does happen. But, you know, they're larger than life, right. A lot of them.
I mean, presumably, I can't bear the more responsibility they've got, the harder it is to get them into the interesting zone, is it?
Yeah, and I can't bear the kind of line to take and the scripted answers. But, you know, you've got to, that's your job as a journalist, is to sort of puncture that. Mm-hmm. I mean, I once did an interview with someone who did the line to take literally the same answer about four times because they thought I was going to clip the interview. And I was so incensed that I ended up using the same answer several times just to make the point that they'd learned what they wanted to say. And I just don't think that's acceptable.
Is it moving on, the political interview? Because, I mean, I'm just thinking about the sort of the Jeremy Paxman interview where Michael Howard said, it was that kind of like...
Well, I kind of miss that bit, but... I miss it, but I do think people don't want that kind of aggression. They want me as the interviewer to absolutely nail this bastard.
But they don't want the repetition either, do they? I mean,
and I think you've got to cut through that, but I think you have to do it in a... I think it needs to be polite but persistent. Yeah. And you've got to... And you don't always get it right. You know, sometimes you say, do I watch my interviews back? Sometimes I think back and think I was too aggressive in that one. Or, I mean, rarely not aggressive enough, to be honest, because... You know, your instinct is always to jump in. And sometimes that's just uncomfortable.
Well, I suppose sometimes you've got to coax and answer, sometimes you've got to see it. But, I mean, I'm just thinking in, like, your two key broadcast outlets at the moment, so Channel 4 and Times Radio. I mean, they're both outlets where I guess you've got a bit of latitude to bring more of a kind of an opinion, more of a kind of... something more than just reporting the news, I guess.
I think you can bring passion to Channel 4 News, but I don't think you can bring an opinion.
You can't bring an opinion,
I mean, hopefully, I hope no one knows which way I vote, because I don't think it's obvious from my output. And obviously, although Times Radio is regulated in a slightly different way, you know, I'm still a public service journalist, so I sort of apply the same... Well, I have to apply the same standard. But I think the difference is Times Radio, you've got longer to let an interview spool out, so that's quite nice.
Is there a different level of enjoyment between radio, long form, and sort of the kind of bright lights, cameras, and TV?
It's so different. I mean, I'm fortunate to have a very varied job, even on Channel 4, because I do my investigative stuff, but I also do the kind of live moments. So, and there's just so much... You know, I love doing the big live TV thing. That's great. But, you know, I also love digging away.
Is that because of the buzz? Is that because you're around a great moment? And
there's nothing beats it. You know, a big political, you know, the fall of a prime minister, or, you know, I was literally yards away when Rishi Sunak left and Keir Starmer came in Downing Street. I mean, that, you remember things like, I don't know, just watching that, how... There was one moment where Keir Starmer was with... Ringside Seat, The Making of History and all that. But it's just little moments where you see the human being.
Right. You're going to say Keir Starmer.
Keir Starmer was there with Vic, his wife. You know, their life was about to change irrevocably. And I just noticed that he was there sort of greeting people, the crowds of his party supporters. And I could see Vic sort of suddenly sort of left on her own. And I was thinking, oh, God, when's he going to turn back? And, like, you know, and it was just a silly little thing, but it's just, you think your way into their heads at that point and think, what are they thinking? What's she thinking? This is it. My prime minister now, my husband, is now prime minister. And he's been sort of captured by the machine.
Do you ever find out? Because they're fantastically human dramas, aren't they?
Yeah. Yeah.
But do those dramas stay private?
It's interesting because I talked about this on Have I Got News For You, of all places, but I bumped into the Prime Minister and his wife I was having dinner with a contact, and they were over the other side of the room, and suddenly you get this sort of whoosh of security, and there they are, and, you know, I went to say hello to them. And he was in the middle of signing all these trade deals, and I just, you know, rather, it was their anniversary dinner, they said to me, so I didn't want to sort of be a gooseberry and, you know, doorstep him.
Ask him a question on the record.
Yeah, exactly. But I was just like, you know, oh gosh, you know, everything must be all quite overwhelming. And he sort of let out a sigh, and I just thought, you can sort of see from the body language of someone like that in that situation, the weight of responsibility. And there they were, grabbing a few hours for an anniversary dinner. Mm. You know, they must have stayed about an hour and a half, and then it's back to negotiating the next trade.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think for a lot of people, that being outside of that kind of bubble is kind of like when you do get those peaks in. I mean, it's just a whole other world.
Yeah.
I guess the pressure's on it. But I suppose you though, as well as your broadcast style. I mean, you bring a campaigning style into your own life. And I mean, that's a good segue back into music, because tell us about Music for All and music education.
Yeah, so yeah. I'm an ambassador for Music for All. I just think I really noticed bringing up our own kids, so they're 20 and 16 now, but they've always played the violin. I took the working mum's shortcut and said, look, I know how to do this. Here's
they
a violin.
Have a choice, Kathy. No.
but they did the Suzuki school, which was interesting because it was a whole different ball game from how I learned. But I was really... So they both went to the Guildhall School of Music. Mm-hmm. And it was really striking that when they were there, they went to the local state school, but there was hardly anybody else who attended a state school there. And I just thought it was such a change from my childhood, where it was actually quite diverse, the people who did music. You didn't have to be wealthy. You know, my parents were not wealthy. We were just solidly middle class, and we could afford music lessons.
And it was just a given.
Yeah.
Like music just seemed to be a big part of people's lives.
And it was part of school, and ordinary schools. And that just isn't the case anymore. So Music for All, the whole remit is to bring it to a wider audience at a time when I think that is just so needed. Because, you know, I think the Proms, for example, here at the Albert Hall, they do a great job of diversifying access. But you go to a classical music concert and it's very niche, the audience. And I think that's a great shame.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of the reasons why I think with the RPO is the diversity of programming is a big part of actually the diversity of audience and actually how you take that forward. But I mean, it's also, I mean, the fact that, I mean, tough times, tough decisions. I mean, culture, the arts often has to pay quite a high price in that environment. Do you worry about that?
Yeah, I worry about it a lot, but I also think it's really short-sighted because Britain is, you know, I can hardly get my words out. I'm so infuriated by this, because creative industries is something that Britain excels at.
Yeah.
And it's a great sort of export opportunity, and we have incredible talent that we nurture, and, you know, specialist music schools, for example. But, you know, that doesn't seem to me that has been front of mind of successive governments.
Well, because I think it's intangible, isn't it? It's quite hard to sort of, like, you know, stab it, put a value on it, box it up. But I think you know, creativity, I mean, A, it's hugely important sort of for a nation commercially, for a person's life. But as you say, we've excelled at it. But I suppose, do you get a sense that...
Well, also Keir Starmer played the flute at the Guildhall, so, you know, he should understand.
He should get it. But I suppose, is there a kind of message here? Because I mean, we're sat in the Henry Cole room, and of course, he was the inspiration, the driving force behind the Royal Albert Hall, the great exhibition. I suppose the epitome of thinking big. I mean, I think, is culture one of those areas that we could think a hell of a lot bigger?
Yeah. Yes, absolutely. But I also think thanks to people like Henry Cole, we have big thoughts from previous generations that we need to nurture and preserve and make accessible to a wider audience. I mean, you know, the way musicians are treated, the touring issues post-Brexit have not been sorted in this latest round of trade negotiations with the EU. So I know a lot of musicians are hugely concerned about that. Mm. The culture department might get split up. What does that mean for culture and the arts? I mean, I think it's just always been an afterthought, because there's been, you know, it's probably because there's been a sort of perma crisis in governments around the world. So the arts are always sort of like nice to have, but not essential. But for me, they are essential. And I think that's really worth remembering.
And presumably there's got to be a bigger team that gets behind it, because if government can't do it, or presumably it's going to have to be big amounts of philanthropy. Other people stepping in.
Because a lot of charitable institutions are absolutely on their knees.
Yeah.
So I think it is about, attracting philanthropists and hopefully showcasing what amazing institutions we have for the arts in this country.
I'm just thinking, you mentioned your daughters are musicians, and I was just thinking about how their journeys have differed to yours in terms of your kind of, I suppose, the generational difference in terms of actually how music has affected their lives.
Well, I suppose we're lucky because we live in London, so actually there's a load of music on their doorsteps and our doorsteps that I didn't have ready access to. So that's kind of incredible. You know, we've always probably annoyed them by taking them off to concerts and things like that. But it's the school stuff that is, their school does have a grand piano, but a lot of schools don't. And I think there's some great initiatives going on. For example, you know, mandolin orchestras at schools. I think the experiment of giving every child a free violin for a while is probably not a great idea, because right. it's not the easiest instrument to just pick up. You need to be taught in the right way, I think.
There's a journey into it.
Yeah, right? Much as it pains me to say that. But, you know, the idea of everyone picking up a guitar or a mandolin, you know, something like that, it does...
Yeah.
It's a good idea. It's a good initiative.
I mean, I've been reflecting on something you said early on, which is that it's almost like you met a teacher too late. It was one experience... later, and I'm presuming that in your media career you met people at the right time to sort of, you know, the pathway. Would you change, if I could wave a magic wand and allow you to give some advice to yourself when you were thinking about the journey of music, where presumably you were completely pumped about the possibilities, about the commitment, about maybe sticking with it. Would you change your mind?
You know what? I wouldn't, because I do see so many professional musicians, and actually the old lady that I spoke about earlier, I think she was right, because I think it is a very hard life for a lot of musicians. And, you know, I'm very fortunate that I have a really interesting job and I have a really exciting life. I'm very lucky with that.
And a passion you can keep.
Yeah, and now music is pure fun. Whereas there was a period where when I did think that I wanted it, when I wanted to play music professionally, that actually I found it almost too painful to pick it up after I'd made the decision to ditch that, because I just would always find the mistakes in what I was playing. Yeah. Whereas now I pick up the violin and I'm nowhere near as good as I was, but I just love it and it's pure enjoyment.
Well, and pure enjoyment. And I saw the photograph of you with the statutory instruments in the Chamber of the House of Commons. I mean...
What a fun moment. Yeah, and we have such great fun. You know, we're playing at the Women's Prize, for example, in the gardens in Bedford Square. You know, we get all these amazing, lovely, fun gigs, and we need to practice more. We definitely need to practice more. But, you know, the other members of the quartet bring music that I've never heard of, like the Danish String Quartet is one that has become a bit of a favourite of ours. And, you know, so it's just a whole sort of new learning experience, really, and a very enjoyable one.
Brilliant. A passionate case for the amateur musician.
Definitely.
With lots of fun, lots of pleasure. Kathy Newman, thank you very much for joining me on Journeys.
Thank you.